Peter B. Collins, News and Comment for Thursday, April 28th, 2016. If you wrote an email to the big guy upstairs, would the FBI be allowed to read it without a warrant? Well, according to current law, there's a good chance that that is the case. And I'm shocked and pleased to report to you that yesterday, in a unanimous vote, 419-0, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives passed a bill that will update the 1986 Email Communications Privacy Act by requiring all federal agencies, with few exceptions, I'm told, to get a warrant before searching old digital communications stored in the cloud by companies like Google and Facebook. Now, I want to see what those exceptions are. But if we can take this at face value, this is an important step forward. Just a year ago, the Congress went through this bizarre machination where they passed the USA Freedom Act that had been gutted by the FBI. And while it nominally changed who holds on to our phone records that are collected in bulk, and does require technically a warrant for the government to access the phone records, the bill was so weak and did so little to change the dynamic of massive surveillance of innocent Americans by our own government that this is a surprising step forward. So I consider this to be really good news, and I hope that when I get around to reading the fine print, that I don't have to come back to you sheepishly and say, oh, well, there was this huge exception for national security, the Homeland Security Department, you know, who knows. But that is the word that I have so far. There's more news in the American surveillance state, and I want to credit Glenn Greenwald for amplifying a position that he has expressed for some time. And that is, there's a new study out that confirms that when people believe that authorities are watching our actions online, we censor ourselves, we limit our behavior, we stop visiting certain websites, or we won't make certain comments in social media because we don't want to be flagged, we don't want to seem suspicious. Now, a new study shows that there has been a 20% decline in page views on Wikipedia articles related to terrorism, those that mention Al-Qaeda, car bomb, Taliban. People are afraid to read articles about those topics because they're afraid that, well, there is somebody who is checking their browsing history. And this could become evidence that could be used in some twisted way in the future. And so this really is having a chilling effect. And I will admit that I think twice about going to WikiLeaks. I have been there. But I imagine there's a huge trap that captures every IP address of a person who visits WikiLeaks. And likewise, I think twice about going to certain places where I suspect that there is enhanced government interest, shall we say. A 2015 study examined Google search data and said that post-Ed Snowden, users were less likely to search using terms that they believe might get them in trouble with the U.S. government. A study from the Poets and Authors Group, PEN America, found that 1 in 6 writers have curbed their content out of fear of surveillance, showed that writers are not only overwhelmingly worried about government surveillance, but are engaging in self-censorship as a result. British libraries refuse to house any material on the Taliban for fear of being prosecuted for material support of terrorism. And Greenwald cites Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon, the theory that behaviors of large groups of people can be effectively controlled, just by letting them know that it's possible that they're being watched at any given moment. And he pats himself on the back that he gave a TED Talk in 2014 on this issue. Now, here's where I sour a little bit on Greenwald's commentary, because he talks about back in 2008, he researched WikiLeaks, interviewed its founder, Julian Assange, and found that they'd been engaging in vital transparency projects around the world. So, says Greenwald, I wrote an article describing their work and recommended that my readers support that work either by donating or volunteering, and I included links for how they could do so. And in response, a large number of people expressed, he said, the fear to him. While they support WikiLeaks' work, they were petrified that supporting them would cause them to end up on a government list or something. Now, what Greenwald doesn't reference here is that his patron at First Look Media and The Intercept, Pierre Omidyar, is a founder of PayPal. And while I can't directly state that Pierre Omidyar intervened with PayPal to cut off funding for WikiLeaks, we know that PayPal did so, and we know that banks and credit card companies collaborated with the government as well. And that's an important episode that should be a part of the story that Glenn Greenwald tells today. And it's interesting, our Facebook buddy, staunch listener and subscriber from Columbus, Ohio, Carl Howard, posted The Intercept's article and on Facebook got some very interesting comments. A guy named Dan says, catching terrorists is way down the list of benefits. Increasing compliance and eliminating dissent is the major nexus of the electronic panopticon. Drew says, if you aren't on a government watch list already, you aren't American enough. Don't be afraid to stand up to injustice. And Scott says, you don't even have to actually say anything radical for the feds police to fuck up your life. They can simply misinterpret your words and start stalking, harassing you. And Sean says, well, I can tell you it hasn't changed my behavior. I still call it as I see it and fuck them if they don't like what I say. Julie says, Big Brother personified. In China, they're instituting a mandatory app where people have to check in. The oppression is not imagined. Chris says, just the thought of surveillance can make one compliant. Retaining Guantanamo, keeping the Patriot Act, Homeland Security, TSA, security checks everywhere are all part of the end game to keep us in line, compliant, and fearful. They all need to go. They're nothing more than the SS tactics that were used in Nazi Germany. And here Michael O'Neill echoes my thinking. Cattle call surveillance of every boarding airline passenger serves the same purpose. It has zero relationship with actual security concerns, yet is immensely effective at instilling a desired passivity, or learned helplessness, as some people call it, in a population. And that's why I call it airport security theater, because that's the main goal of the elaborate delays that we all have to submit to just because you want to fly on an airplane. Also at The Intercept, reporters Cora Currier and Murtaza Hussein publish a detailed look at a new FBI program, which is called, it's aimed at de-radicalizing or anti-radicalization of those who are suspected of leanings toward the Islamic State or other jihadi or terrorist groups. The idea of the committees, called Shared Responsibility Committees, is to enlist counselors, social workers, religious figures, and other community members to intervene with people the FBI thinks are in danger of radicalizing. Now, first of all, how do you become a candidate for the work of the Shared Responsibility Committees? Is it because the FBI checked your email or your Facebook post or tapped your phone or had one of these operatives pick you up at a mosque? Well, that isn't detailed. But there is a letter aimed at, it's being sent to potential committee members from the FBI, and it says that the committees will not be used as a means to gather intelligence. And that denial is something that makes me skeptical out of the gate. But at the same time, committee members have to keep their work secret and are forbidden from even seeking advice from outside experts without permission from the FBI. So this is a very one-way system. And so far, we haven't seen any evidence of de-radicalization that has been attempted. Mostly, we've seen the FBI framing up these schlubs who express some interest to a paid FBI informant, often triggered by the informant's entrapment. So this is a revealing effort, and I have no confidence in it in terms of helping people who might be leaning toward what's called radicalization. And it ends up examining people's thinking and then deciding that their thinking is not correct, and therefore, well, you need to visit a shared responsibility committee, young man. And get this, at the Brennan Center for Justice, Mike German, a former FBI agent, said, "Our society has set up a number of protective zones where you're allowed to be candid with your doctor, your clergy, and to a certain extent within a school system with student privacy laws, and we have the attorney-client privilege," I'll add that. He says, "This program that the FBI is setting up seems not to acknowledge those privileges, and in fact, seems to be intent on undermining them." And Abed Ayyub, who is legal director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, said, "There are many reasons why we feel the SRC program is problematic, but the main reason is that the FBI seems to be outsourcing its intelligence gathering and surveillance to the community." And by denying that that's what they're doing, it appears I'm not the only one who is suspicious of what the true intentions are. And they've attempted this in Britain with mixed results. British individuals cited in this article say that the program started off somewhat independent from the government and is now completely captive to it. So this article does confirm that there are at least 15,000 domestic FBI informants, paid informants. We know they're paid because there's a line item in the budget that suggests the 15,000 figure. So this is just another creeping police state disclosure, and it shows that while nominally the Congress wants to preserve some modicum of privacy for our emails, if you happen to be Muslim or somehow otherwise targeted by the FBI, that all goes out the window. Jason Leopold's at it again with a FOIA disclosure about the CIA. Over at Vice News, he reports that the Central Intelligence Agency has violated federal laws and its own regulations by hiring independent contractors for a wide variety of intelligence and national security-related work that, under law, is supposed to be performed by government employees. And it appears that the CIA is not only acting above the law, but is out of control on this particular issue. And I have been in touch with Jason, and I'm hoping to record an interview with him early next week. He's been traveling. But I want to talk to him about the case in Spokane, Washington, where the two contractors who were paid millions of dollars by the CIA to provide the architecture of the torture program, these are Mitchell and Jessen, they are the subjects of a lawsuit that is proceeding and was not blocked by state secret assertions by the federal government. So coming back to the current article here, what Leopold lays out is that the number of contractors has surged since 9/11, and at some point, the number of actual employees of the agency was lower than the number of contractors that they had hired. Now, some of the laws say that you can't outsource the work. You can't, for example, have CIA spies who aren't employees. And that kind of makes sense because of regulations of the security of information and, you know, many other issues. You just don't want freelancers doing the work of government employees. And the Inspector General report also shows that in violation of explicit federal law, the agency used independent contractors to conduct phone and in-person interviews of applicants for employment within the National Clandestine Service. And that is explicitly prohibited under federal law. And Tim Shorrock, who's been a guest on this program, he wrote the book Spies for Hire. He said the report makes clear that the National Clandestine Service appears to be almost unrestrained in its use of independent contractors. I think this will probably rank as the most outrageous news story of the day. An Oklahoma criminal appeals court has stunned local prosecutors with a declaration that state law does not criminalize oral sex with a victim who is completely unconscious. And this is a case of victim blaming. A 16-year-old girl who'd been drinking in a park and was badly intoxicated, so badly that she had to be carried to the car driven by the 17-year-old boy who has been accused of basically getting her to perform oral sex on him while she was blacked out, unconscious, because of her heavy consumption of alcohol. Now, on the face of it, this is outrageous. Because if this girl was sexually violated in this manner, even if she was unconscious, it does raise questions about this guy's ability to be aroused and to use an inanimate human being as a sexual receptacle. I'm sorry to put it in such terms. What happened was, after this boy apparently had this sexual encounter with her, he dropped her off at her grandmother's house. She was unconscious. They took her to a hospital. They showed her blood alcohol content was 0.34 or higher, and staff conducted a sexual assault examination as she was regaining consciousness. And they found evidence around her mouth of DNA from the suspect and also on the back of her leg. Now, one of the issues that I will raise, consistent with the court decision, is not to blame her as the victim, but to simply, establish that if she was unconscious when he allegedly ejaculated in her mouth or some form of sex like that, she, can't really be a witness to testify against him. So you have the circumstantial evidence of his DNA, but if he doesn't admit, that he used her sexually in this manner, then there is a gap in the law. And that's what experts say is the issue here, because forcible oral sodomy is treated differently under Oklahoma law as compared to intercourse and anal sex. And those are banned, and even if the person is too intoxicated to consent to it. So clearly Oklahoma law needs to be updated. But this is a case certainly that will upset many people when they learn about it. We've also learned that sources in Minneapolis report that Prince, at the time of his death, had apparently Percocet pills on his person and in his home. And the suspicion is that Prince became hooked on these opioid painkillers after he was told that he needed a double hip replacement. And so I assume from that he was living with quite a bit of constant pain. And he reportedly got hooked on the Percocet pills. And I hope that, if this is confirmed, and if the autopsy, confirms these same suspicions, that people don't turn on Prince and turn him into some, drug-addled monster who, doesn't deserve our respect. Because there are millions of people who have used opioid painkillers, and the drug companies and doctors are responsible for the widespread availability and the prescriptions that are often given to people when they shouldn't be. And so we need to, I hope that Prince's death, if this is indeed the cause, will lead to a further examination and not some sort of an effort to demonize Prince after he died. Well, the Sanders campaign has announced that they're laying off hundreds of campaign staff workers. And this is being interpreted as the campaign is over, they're hunkering down, they're going to go through the motions for the rest of the primaries. And I'm not so sure about this. But it is a natural turn of events. You can imagine if Sanders were trending ahead of Clinton, with all the money that they've raised, they would keep the staff members for the rest of the campaign all the way to November. Now, I can't get into the minds of the campaign leadership at the Sanders for President Committee, but this is being interpreted as a signal that they are winding down the campaign. And the delegate gap currently is 333 of the pledged delegates between Sanders and Clinton. And I still believe that there is a path where he can deny Hillary the nomination. But I'm not sure that Bernie Sanders is going to take that route. I'm also not sure if he will respond to the many suggestions that are being offered by his supporters, that he either run with the Green Party, with Jill Stein as his running mate, and it's not clear to me if Stein would accept the vice presidency in putting Bernie on the Green Party ticket. But over at The Hill, which is a website and publication for political people in Washington, a guy named Tim Farley wrote a piece advocating, or at least examining, the potential of Sanders bolting from the Democratic Party. And in this case, he looks more at running as an independent than the possibility of joining the Green Party. And I have not been promoting this notion for a number of reasons. One is, we haven't seen the end of the Sanders campaign. Number two, running as an independent is really dicey. It is very difficult to get on the ballot in many states. And in this article from The Hill, Farley says that Sanders has time. The deadline for procuring sufficient signatures to be on the November ballot has yet to pass in almost all of the states. Now, ballot access is my biggest concern. The second issue is that an independent has to have sufficient strength to win states, because winning the popular vote is meaningless. You have to win states in order to rack up electoral college votes. And this was what happened to Ross Perot in 92. He got 19-20% of the popular vote, but he didn't win a single state, and he didn't have a single electoral college vote. Now, the other issue is that certainly the Democrats won't be happy if Sanders renounces the pledges he has made to support the eventual Democratic nominee. But he's made some great comments in recent days about how it's not up to him to snap his fingers and tell the Byrne followers to support Clinton, but it is up to her to woo his supporters by showing that she really will make progress on the issues that he has raised. And my friend John Stauber, very bright guy, he's retired now. He was a founder of the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin. He published a piece at Counterpunch yesterday, which is an I told you so kind of theme. And he says, from the moment that Sanders announced, it was obvious what would happen. It was obvious that his campaign would end as it is now wrapping up, with Bernie begrudgingly conceding that he can't win against Hillary's oligarchy backing and the rigged process of establishment superdelegates designed to make sure that no self-proclaimed democratic socialist type ever wins the nomination. He compares it to Groundhog Day and cites, Jesse Jackson, Jerry Brown, Howard Dean, and you get the point. So he says, well, this is the death spiral of the Feel the Burn movement, the 2 million who have forked over time and money are now facing. And he says, all this I predicted, as could any objective fool, the day of Bernie's announcement. Yes, it's been heartening to see the extent of his support, but of course it is all for naught. In 4 months, Hillary's army will command Bernie's list of 2 million, and Bernie and his loyal Democratic minions will be weaving memes of how the party will soon be in the hands of the Feel the Burn rebellion. Not this year, not next, but soon, brothers and sisters, the revolution will occur. And, clearly, Stauber is cynical. He says, for all the noble tirades of the progressives, from Moyers to Sanders, about the power of money and how it must be removed from the process, it is the process itself that is the problem. And he says that Sanders should have been using this to build a third party. And that's nice in the abstract. But as I've been talking about just a moment ago, the system is rigged to lock out third parties. And so I think that it's a difficult path forward. Also, I want to recommend a piece that I found at Counterpunch when I went to get John Stauber's article, written by Alfredo Lopez. And he is a Bernie supporter of color who comments on how weak the support of voters of color has been for Bernie Sanders this year. And he, in a loving way, criticizes Sanders for not developing real connections to, in particular, African-American voters in this country. Well, Donald Trump gave a speech yesterday. He actually read a speech from a teleprompter. And it was about foreign policy. And he stepped all over himself. It was a confusing array where, in turn, he would talk about isolationism. He used the slogan, America First, without appearing to know that it is a loaded phrase, an anti-Semitic expression that comes out of the isolationists before World War II in this country. And he, he talked tough at times, and he talked like everything is just a deal. And he threatened our allies. It is just an incredible mess, what he offered. And in several cases, he would say one thing and turn around and contradict himself within, 30 seconds or so. And to try to distract us from all that, Ted Cruz made the big announcement yesterday that his campaign, that's going absolutely nowhere, has taken on a vice presidential candidate. And she is Carly Fiorina. And he is betting that she can help him, score better against Trump in California. And it's a huge miscalculation. We hate Carly Fiorina in California. She tried to run against Barbara Boxer in 2010, and it was just a debacle. And then she got meaner and ran for president this year and failed at that. And the fine folks at Morning Consult emailed me some recent polling about Carly Fiorina, and she is viewed more unfavorably than favorably. Only 26% of the entire population views her favorably, while 43% is unfavorable and 31% have never heard of the broad. And so it's especially critical, the Republican side. 36% support her, 36% don't, and 28% have no opinion. So there is no benefit to this desperate move by Ted Cruz, who drew some lovely comments from John Boehner, the Merlot-drinking former Speaker of the House, who called Ted Cruz at Stanford University yesterday Lucifer in the flesh. And then he told a retired history professor at Stanford, I get along with almost everyone, but I've never worked with a more miserable son of a bitch in my life. There's just so much love going around everywhere, isn't there? I will applaud the Obama administration for pressing the states to reduce sharply the use of solitary confinement in our prisons. The estimate is there are about 100,000 people in lockdown segregated cells right now, and only 10,000 of those are in federal lockups. The other 90,000 are in state-run prisons, and the state doesn't control the policies. The federal government doesn't control the policies of the state incarceration agencies. So this is mostly a bully pulpit call, trying to set an example and get the trend moving, and I fully support it. Yesterday, I ended with a couple of stories about scandals in the San Francisco Police Department. We're on the second wave of scandals related to racist and otherwise offensive text messages traded between police officers. And today, It's been announced that a former San Francisco police lieutenant has been implicated in the case that helped expose the latest homophobic and racist text messages. This gets a little confusing. The former lieutenant, is named Curtis Liu, L-I-U. He is accused of covering up for Officer Jason Lai, L-A-I. So Liu lied for Lai, if you can handle that. And what he's accused of is tipping off the cop that he was the subject of a rape investigation. And it was that investigation that exposed these text messages that are now of great concern. But this underscores one of my fundamental complaints about law enforcement in this country and why they appear to be above the law and operate with impunity even when they clearly break the law. And that is because of the code of silence, that good cops cover up for bad cops. Good cops tip off the bad cops that they're being investigated. And this has got to stop. And so I am glad that the district attorney, George Gascon, who, by the way, was the police chief before he moved over to the DA's office, he has indicted Curtis Liu. He's charged with a felony count of making a false statement in a police report and two counts of delaying or obstructing a peace officer. And I hope that they try this man and throw the book at him, because we need more prosecutions and convictions of bad cops in order to clean up our sordid law enforcement agencies across the country. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. You're free to share this podcast with absolutely anyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.